When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Paul Ramsbottom. He's the chief executive of the Wolfson Foundation. They've been awarding the Wolfson History Prize since 1972. It is a beacon of the best historical writing being produced in the UK. This year's winner will be announced on Monday, the 4th of June, at a reception at Claridge's in London. Also with us is S.R. Summers, who holds a degree in history from the University of Belgium. When not managing her cafe, you'll find her busy writing and working on the final book in her Infinity Squared 8-part series. The first book, Indigo Lost, is out now, blending elements of crime, fantasy, romance, and coming of age with social fiction. Also on tonight's book show is Sue Watson, who was a journalist before starting a career in TV. As a producer with the BBC, she worked on garden makeovers, kitchen takeovers, and daytime sofas before leaving television to write. Some of her books include Fat Girls and Fairy Cakes, Younger, Thinner, Blonder, and Summer Flings and Dancing Dreams. Some great titles. Her latest book, Love, Lies, and Wedding Cake, is the perfect laugh-out-loud romantic comedy. And finally on tonight's show is Mark Edwards, a number one best-selling thriller author who's sold over a million copies of his books worldwide. His latest psychological thriller with a horror twist is The Retreat, which explores our modern obsession with urban legends. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Paul Ramsbottom, who's the chief executive of the Wolfson Foundation. They have recently shortlisted six authors. That's been announced for the Wolfson History Prize. The award has been taking place since 1972, and the overall winner is going to be announced on Monday, the 4th of June, at a reception in Claridge's, London. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you very much, Hannah.
Pleasure.
Lovely to join you.
Oh, thanks very much for joining us. So tell us a bit more about the Wolfson Foundation, can you?
Well, the Wolfson Foundation is a large endowed charity. We were set up in the 1950s, so we've been going 60 years. And in that time, we've given away, in real terms, about £1.8 billion to great projects across the UK. It's a great privilege to act as chief executive of the organisation. Mm. We do lots of different funding programs, among them an emphasis on heritage and history, and of course that's where the Wolfson History Prize slots in to our activities.
And that's been taking place since 1972?
That's right, so it's been a prize that's been awarded annually for what the judges deem to be the best history book or books each year since 1972, and there's been a kind of an amazing roll call of authors who have won over the years, some of whom have gone on to become household names, like Simon Sharma, for example, Martin Gilbert, Mary Beard. What's quite interesting to my mind is that in the last couple of years, we've tweaked the format slightly. So previously, we'd simply announced a couple of books as the winners. I guess it's a reflection of just how much great history is being written now. Last year and this year, we've announced a shortlist, and so we've been able to throw a spotlight on more books. Six books have been announced. And the intention is, I guess, that for those authors, it's great, they get a spotlight on their books. But also, actually, it sort of helps to generate a bit of debate and discussion as to which of the six might be the eventual winner. And in a wider sense, I suppose, what is it that makes great history, and why it should be that there's as much, if not more, interested in history now than there ever has been, at least in the UK.
It must be difficult, a challenge, I suppose, for many history writers and lovers of history to try and find a particular subject or a particular angle that hasn't been done before.
I think that's right, to find a subject, an angle that hasn't been done before, something that's kind of fresh and interesting, maybe even provocative. And then I think the other hurdle, certainly for authors who are getting on the Wolfson shortlist, is that it's got to be accessible to an audience of people who are not professional historians. You know, I guess there is a role within universities, for example, to write very specialist, very detailed monographs about a very specific subject, but they're not the books that the judges of the Wolfson History Prize are interested in. They're interested in books which hit the highest standards from a scholarly perspective, do exactly what you touch on, Hannah, which is, in a sense, break some new ground in one way or another, either in their arguments or in the area that they're focusing on. And then the last thing, which is also absolutely crucial, is that they've got to sparkle. I mean, it would be brilliantly written, and they've got to be the kind of book that you would pack with a sense of anticipation when you're heading away on holiday. You know, it's that kind of book that we're looking for. So it's quite a high standard, actually.
Mm, absolutely. And are all the books non-fiction?
They are. They are. I mean, I'm very conscious that there's a kind of booming world of historic fiction, but this is non-fiction, mainstream history books, which, to be fair to the judges, already gives them a pretty wide canvas. I mean, just to put it in context, I think the judges looked at and read somewhere between 150 and 200 books.
Gosh.
Which is quite a number. And then, of course, whittled down to the six that have just been announced.
Mm. So I guess the fact that with non-fiction books, history particularly, the key has to be research. It needs to be, all of the books and the stories have to be researched meticulously, and all the facts have to be correct.
That's right. All of the books are on the list based on original research. Very often, I think, mining archives and angles on the subject that nobody's looked at before. And I think that is part of the excitement of the books. One of them actually is subtitled The Untold Story. I'm thinking of Miranda Kaufman's book. It's her first book, actually, on Black Tudors, Africans in England during the Tudor period. And she quite rightly claims that she's uncovered stories and personalities that have never been known before. And I suppose, to a greater or lesser extent, that's true of all the six books on the list. They're kind of putting a different argument, they're putting a different angle on sometimes quite well-worn, or apparently well-worn, stories. And I think that's part of the excitement of the prize, actually.
I always find it incredible when books are created about either the First World War or the Second World War, and new information is found, which is quite incredible, isn't it?
And given the sheer scale of books that are written on the kind of 20th century conflicts, I do think that is striking. But you will have spotted, Hannah, there are two books which touch on exactly that. And both of them, I think, have got a kind of interesting angle that is unusual. Jan Ruger has written a book based on a small island in the North Sea, an island which is about half the size of Gibraltar, just to put it in context, Heligoland. Mm. And he uses this kind of island as a brilliant motif to talk about the relationship between Britain and Germany and the struggle for the North Sea across, you know, a long period of time. And so, an amazing microcosm of Anglo-German relationship. And then Tim Grady, who's another author who is shortlisted, has written about German Jews in the 20th century, which, you know, you might think has been written about ad infinitum. But his particular angle is talking about the Jewish soldiers who served in the First World War. Then there were about 100,000, and about 12% of them died, about 12,000 casualties, deaths. So a very different angle that, of course, anticipates and provides a really extraordinary perspective on what would happen to that community, tragically, in the kind of decades that followed.
Yeah, very interesting. And there's another one about Victorian medicine.
Yes, The Grisly World of Victorian Medicine, it's subtitled. This is a book by Lindsay Fitzharris, who has written a brilliant book about surgery and medicine in the Victorian era, talking particularly about Joseph Lister and the way in which that young Quaker surgeon transformed the way in which surgery took place. It's, I think, almost certainly in the year since the prize has been running, since 1972, almost certainly the most grisly book that's ever been put on the list. It's full of savagery and soaring and infections, and but actually underpinning, I mean, it's obviously a lot more than that, underpinning that is this amazing story about how surgery changed from being pretty gruesome gateways to death, as they were sometimes called, to being the very elevated, respected profession that it became in the 20th century, and with Lister almost as a key point in that transition. So it's a very, very remarkable book. And interesting, just to show, actually, that not all of the authors are academics at universities. Lindsay's a freelance writer, so the authors come from all kinds of different backgrounds. And different perspectives.
There's another one on the English Reformation.
Yeah, this is written by Peter Marshall. An absolutely superb book. Very wide in scope and sweep. Standing above, I suppose, what has been the stock for a lot of Reformation histories, which is sort of picking which side of the fence you feel were the righteous and just side, but really telling the story in a masterful way. And I think it was really very, very fascinating, particularly for a non-professional historian, in the way that Peter Marshall tells that story, is that on the one hand, he absolutely tells the kind of broad sweep of how these extraordinary changes changed English society, 16th century England. Also, he kind of dives in on the detail. So you get amazing little pen portraits of individuals who were caught up in this, who felt passionately about it, as well as some of the kind of big players, bishops and politicians and so on. And so I think it's an absolutely brilliant history, and it will, I'm sure, be read by anybody interested in the Reformation and what it meant for England for decades to come.
And finally, a book on China.
Yes, and just to show that the prize isn't simply about British or European history, this is about history in all shapes and forms, and of course there's been increased interest in Europe in the global dimensions of history over the last few years, and that's very much reflected in the prize. And this is a book by Robert Bickers called Out of China, How the Chinese Ended the Era of Western Domination. This is a fascinating book for a number of different reasons, not least because of the importance of history and heritage to the way in which China is currently framing itself in the modern world and the way in which it's engaging with the international community. So it tells a very long story of China's engagement with the West, but then goes in for the kind of wonderful detailed stories, the corrupt and lurid story of pre-war Shanghai, the extraordinary tales of these tiny patches of extraterrestrial land that was directly owned and controlled by European powers, like Hong Kong and Macau and so on. And then the story of how China emerged in the 20th century from Western control and what all of that means in terms of relationships, ongoing relationships. So it's an extraordinary book, actually. It's very wide in scope, and of course very different to any of the other five books.
Yeah, it's good.
On the list.
It's good that they're all so different. Is that intentional?
It is. I mean, the overwhelming criteria, of course, is quality. You have to hit a certain standard to be on the list. But I think it is really important and right and proper that the list that the judges choose also reflects the diversity of history being written today and the diversity of people writing that history. It would be a duller list and actually just wouldn't reflect the quality of what was out there if it was very monochrome, if everything was about a very narrow period or everything was being written by the from a kind of similar perspective. So, I mean, it, as you say, it's, you know, it goes from more or less biographical look at Joseph Lister, albeit within a wider context, to a book like Robert Bickers, which is really telling a very broad story, to a kind of microcosm, that's Jan Ruger's book, to something which is telling the story of a community, like the Jews in the First World War or Africans in Tudor England. So it really is wonderfully diverse. And I think why I'm very pleased is I feel this year that somebody who's interested and curious about history could pick up any of the books, whether they know about the subject or not, could delve into it and find themselves completely captivated and absorbed and intrigued by the subjects.
Great. Well, that's the aim, isn't it? Absolutely.
It is.
With any book, I suppose. If people want to find out more about the Wolfson Foundation, they can have a look on your website, wolfson.org.uk, and find out more about the History Prize on that. And we look forward to finding out who the winner's going to be Monday, the 4th of June. Hope the event goes well.
Thank you very much. And it will be announced soon after 7 p.m. on the evening of 4th June. And we'll be putting it out on our website and across Twitter, and we're hoping to provoke lots of debate and discussion between now and the 4th of June about who the identity of the winner might be.
Fantastic. Paul Ramsbottom, Chief Executive of the Wolfson Foundation, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Hannah. Lovely to join you. Great to have a chat.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Talk Radio Europe.
Online at tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Steph Summers, or SR Summers. Previously, she's enjoyed a career working within broadcast media while living in Belgium. She also holds a degree in history from the University of Cambridge. When not managing her cafe, you'll find her busy writing and working on the final book in her Infinity Squared 8-part series. She's with us on the Book Show to talk about the first in the series, Indigo Lost. It blends elements of crime, fantasy, romance and coming of age with social fiction. Welcome to the Book Show, Steph.
Hello.
Hi, thanks very much for joining us and congratulations, your first book.
Yeah, when I first saw a picture of the delivery of books at my parents' house, I burst into tears, so yeah.
Exciting. And I'm very impressed that you already know and have planned that it's going to be an 8-part series.
Yeah, I'm actually finishing book 8, so people don't need to worry that book 2 is going to take forever or that I'm going to die before I finish the series. So it should all be good, so a lot to look forward to.
Brilliant. So when and why did you plan at the beginning that it was going to be an 8-part series?
Well, actually, to begin with, I thought it was going to be a trilogy, so I started writing it and I quickly realised that it was just a much bigger story, so I ended up just having to turn it into 8 books, but actually it works better that way because the infinity symbol is a number 8 turned on its side.
Mm-hmm.
So actually it all works perfectly together.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah. It's as if it was planned.
It's all come magically together, and it's really hard to describe because obviously not many people write an 8-part book series, but the way everything has happened, it's absolutely perfect. So I'm really excited to share it with everyone.
So, looking at your background and your cafe, studying history, working in the media, how has that all come together for you to become an author, do you think?
It's been an interesting journey, I'll agree. My CV probably makes no sense whatsoever, so I'm really glad I don't have to apply for a job right now. I've always been writing since I was sort of 5 years old. I was that little kid that would walk into the library and disdainfully not go in the children's section. And I would sort of go and pile up all these books and get 10 out on my card and march out with my big pile of books and take them home and sit on the sofa and read them from cover to cover. So books have been a massive part of my life since I was a child, and writing fiction and writing stories and just creating other worlds is just something that I've always loved doing. I've been writing proper books since I was about 15. I've written 13, but this is the first one that I've actually taken to print because it's the one I'm happiest with. It's the one I really want to share with the world. And I think the message in it is actually really powerful, and it's one that's really relevant for today. So
can you tell us a bit more about that message, or will that give it away?
Not really. I mean, in the first book, there's quite a few issues that get covered. The role of social services, the role of family, law enforcement, domestic abuse, the issue of sort of the Harvey Weinstein issue of the power of very influential rich people compared to the power of people who have a bad start in life. And then obviously that massive inspirational journey of overcoming obstacles of either social or personal kinds to become a stronger, better person. So there's a lot in there that people can identify with.
Mm.
But on a bigger scale, there's... I do not want to give things away.
No, don't.
otherwise, my editor's going to hunt me down and kill me.
Absolutely.
But there's a much bigger message. I firmly believe that there's a lot of power in collective emotion. So power of people getting behind a cause, and when you really believe in something and making things happen. And it also brings people together. So, you know, you've seen that in some of the protests that we've already had recently, sort of like the gun crime in America, or rather the use of guns with the mass shootings in schools.
Yeah.
And when people really choose to take a stand about something. So it really means a lot to me, but I really want to just inspire people to stand up for the good things and to not do nothing. That's really the main message behind probably all 8 books, is do the right thing, even if it's not the easiest thing.
That's a good message. That's a great message. So your main character is Misty, and she's 7 at the beginning of this book. Is that right?
Yes, she's the child of a woman who you only meet really at the beginning, because she has an unfortunate end. Being very careful how I phrase that. So she runs away from quite an abusive domestic violence situation. But the way she runs away saves her life. But at the same time, in so doing, she discovers something very unique about herself, which she would never have discovered any other way. So there's this sort of yin and yang of the situation. Like, it's amazing what she discovers, and it sets her life on a course that is far beyond what she could imagine at the age of 7. But at the same time, it came at a massive cost and huge tragedy to herself, which obviously is very traumatic to a child. So it's a really interesting psychological situation to sort of start the book off with. And you go on sort of a big journey with her, really, through the 8 books. By the end of the book, she's 24. So you kind of grow up with her a little bit. So by the time she's 20, 21, you kind of have this lovely ability to look back, and you realise with her how far she's come.
Yeah.
Which is really, really nice.
Lovely. So in this book, she ends up in Vegas, and she meets a mob boss called Donny Capello. Can you tell us more about him?
He used to be my favourite character, actually. I love him to bits, really. He's a bit of a dark character. He's quite complex, and he's very conscious of what he does is on the dark side of the line. But obviously, when you're in that sort of world, you can't walk away from it. Once you're in it, it's sort of a one-way street.
Mm.
But he wants to do the right thing by this girl, because he knows she's an innocent. So she's sort of his redemption. So he becomes sort of her protector, not quite her father figure. And obviously she's quite young, but she grows up and she's pretty. And so he has this kind of conflict of interest of wanting to keep her safe from the world and from what his business does. It's a really nice relationship, one that actually lasts the entire series of books. It's really not straightforward. I don't want people to think it's some kind of cliche and, you know, he falls desperately in love and then they live happily ever after. That couldn't be further from the truth, aside from the fact there's another massive character that's on the edge of book one. The antithesis character of Misty is Daryl Blackmore, who is incredibly wealthy, incredibly powerful, has lots of businesses, chauffeurs, cars, skyscrapers, completely different life. The thing is, he's not happy. He's very alone. His parents are dead. He doesn't really trust anyone. So there's this wonderful gradual interplay of how their worlds end up colliding, which is what happens at the very end of book one. So you're on this process of building up to this event where you're just, as a reader, you're like, what's going to happen? So it's really exciting, and then obviously leads straight into book two, where there's just lots of fireworks.
So, yes. Sounds great. So have you been quite disciplined with your writing? Do you write the same amount of time each day or at the same sort of time?
At the moment, I haven't written loads on book 8 recently because I've had to, obviously, the trouble is because I've just launched book 1, so that obviously takes quite a lot of time and it involves other things other than writing. When you launch a book, and when you publish books, it's not just about writing anymore. It suddenly becomes this much bigger entity.
You have to talk to people like me.
Yeah, which is awesome. I love it, honestly, I love them. It's really hard to explain. I mean, this story has sat in my head for 5 years. I've known exactly what was going to happen, exactly where it was going to end since the beginning. I have this strange brain that just stores information indefinitely. The way I see it is as a movie inside my head, so I'm deconstructing it to write it, and I use music to help me to choreograph scenes or fight scenes. Unless I write it, it just replays and replays in my head. So it becomes a kind of torture unless I write it.
Quite handy, really.
It's handy, but I really, at the moment, I've just wanted a bit of brain space to myself because I've got so many characters, and I'm coming to the climax of the book, and it's quite overwhelming, all the different emotions of all these people. So it's hard work. I wrote it as a continuous thing, so I didn't divide it into 8 books to start off with. I don't write the same amount every day. I usually write a scene or a couple of scenes. I don't do chapters. That's another thing people will notice about my books. So it's more like watching, it's like reading a movie, sort of thing. So it's a bit of a different style. I'm not one of those, I sit down every day at a desk at this time and I write for 2 hours, partly because I can't, because I run a business. So I tend to go with the flow, and once I'm in my zone, I'm gone. Like, I sometimes go into one of the local cafes in my hometown, not my own, and my friend runs it, and she's come up to me and she's like, "Are you okay?" And I've got tears running down my face because I'm feeling everything with my characters, and I'm like, "Yeah, I'm fine." But she just sort of leaves me alone, and that's how I do it. I have to feel it. I can't just turn it on and off like a tap. When I'm really with the story and with my characters, that's everything to me.
So yeah,
that's probably why I've had some amazing feedback from people that have read it so far, and people get really involved with the characters. That's exactly what I wanted.
Brilliant. So can you tell us where Infinity Squared comes from, what that means, the relevance of that?
It's slightly scientific. So there's something that Misty is able to do in the books, which I haven't come up with the mathematical formula, but in my head it involves the Infinity Squared symbol. That is half of it. And then it's also, the Infinity Squared refers to her and Daryl Blackmore, who are both very unique entities. They're very exceptional in their own ways. So it's, when you put those together, it's like Infinity Squared. So it's just a bit of symbology which kind of runs gradually through the book. Obviously not so much in book 1, but more 3 to 8, really. So in the end, it makes a lot of sense.
Okay, great stuff. Well, if people want to get a copy of your debut novel, it's called Indigo Lost, and it's out now by S.R. Summers, who we've been chatting to. Steph, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is journalist and author Sue Watson to talk about her latest book, Love, Lies and Wedding Cake. Other books of Sue's include Fat Girls and Fairy Cakes, Younger, Thinner, Blonder and Love, Lies and Lemon Cake. There's a distinct cake theme, I feel. Welcome to the show, Sue.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks very much for joining us. Am I right in the cake theme?
There definitely is. I did veer a little towards dancing in one book, Summer Flings and Dancing Dreams, which is set in Spain, actually. And that sort of was inspired by Strictly and all the sort of Argentine tango. But the rest of my books are mainly about cake, which is a strange thing. But you see, I do love the research that's involved. That's part of it.
Yes, that makes perfect sense.
Absolutely.
What are your favourite cakes, then?
Well, my favourite cake is Black Forest Gatto. I love, and you see, I can convince myself because there are cherries in it that it's one for five a day.
Yeah, exactly.
And chocolate's supposed to be good for you, isn't it? Chocolate's supposed to be good.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that's quite a healthy cake to have. and last year, actually, I'd forgotten this, I did veer slightly away from cake last year because I wrote two books about ice cream, Ella's Ice Cream Summer, which again involved such a lot of research.
Yeah.
You know, it was hard work, really. It's hard work.
Research is important, though, isn't it? Because it has to be authentic.
Well, it does. It does. And actually, that's true of a lot of the locations as well. I mean, this new one, Love, Lies and Wedding Cake, half of it is set in Australia. And I haven't been to Australia, though it's somewhere I'd love to go. So I've done an awful lot of research and spoken to Australian friends, and I believe it's authentic. My two Australian friends have read it and say, yes, it's spot on. So, you know, hopefully people will feel that they're visiting there.
Yeah. So whereabouts in Australia have you set then?
In Sydney. It's set in Sydney. I wanted a sort of beach. And also, the Australian hunk that my heroine met in Love, Lies and Lemon Cake, they've actually started a stronger relationship in this second book. It is a second book, but it's actually standalone. So if you haven't read Love, Lies and Lemon Cake, you can read Love, Lies and Wedding Cake straight away, and you don't have to know the hero and the heroine. But the hero, Dan, he's actually Australian and came to Britain and met his love. And she has to go out and visit him. There's lots of problems when she gets out to Australia. It's not as wonderful as she thinks it's going to be, and he has a very big secret that he's not telling her. So it's laughter and tears, I think, to both. And cake, of course.
Fantastic. So tell us more about Dan for people who haven't read the first book. What do we know about Dan?
Okay, well, Dan is, I suppose, you know, he's every woman's dream, really. He's slightly younger than our heroine. She's in her 40s and he's in his late 30s. He's a hunk. And he's fair-haired and sort of tanned, permanently tanned Australian wherever he is. He just seems to tan. But the thing about Dan is that he's understanding in a way that our heroine's called Faye, wasn't. Her husband just was obsessed with his business of plumbing. He was a plumber. And, you know, he was more concerned about flanges and, you know, all sorts of faucets and taps and pipes, and he really wasn't bothered about Faye. So when she meets Dan, he's a completely different kind of man, really, and she never realised that these men existed, and he's sensitive and caring. But the really wonderful thing about him is he just loves food, and so does she, and he's a fantastic baker, and he can bake the most amazing cakes. So, he bakes with love, and he cooks with love as well, and he creates all kinds of wonderful dishes. And, you know, their journey, their romantic journey is probably, you know, certainly partly a journey of food, really, as well as everything else. But he awakens every appetite that she has, and they, as I say, in the first book, that's the story, really. But the second book, this Love, Lies and Wedding Cake, is really about the fact that these things, life moves on and people change slightly, and, you know, can we still fall in love with somebody that we loved a few years before if we're not married and geography takes us apart? Then, you know, where does this go and what can happen in the meantime to change these people?
Because their relationship up until this point, they've travelled and met all over the world, haven't they, which must have been exciting.
They've had a wonderful life and a little bit unrealistic. She's gone from this domesticity, this home life of living with a plumber and married and, you know, the boring sort of everyday things, to this wonderful sort of life which she's managing to finance. She's not sort of rich or anything. She basically has weekends away with Dan, and they go and they meet in lovely places and they do really nice things now and then, as often as they can. And, you know, that's wonderful, but it's not real. And it's about really what happens. You know, are we destined to always get married and live with somebody and it just be the same again? Or, you know, are things with different people a different experience? And as I say, the big problem really for Faye and Dan in this book is the secret that he has back in Australia that she doesn't know about.
Mm-hmm. And Faye has a daughter, Emma, which she needs to consider.
She does. And it's a dilemma, you know, many women, certainly sort of, you know, I mean, in the 40s and 50s, you know, we have parents to consider, which Faye sadly has lost her mother. But, you know, often we're at that sort of squeezed middle where we have parents to consider, children to consider. And really, you know, when a woman's in her sort of 50s, 40s and 50s, you know, this could be her time for herself, really. Children growing up, children grown up. But suddenly, for Faye, her daughter has had a daughter. And so she now needs childcare. And Faye, being the mother she is, she wants to be there for her daughter and her granddaughter. And again, this sort of geography that we sort of often have to fight with in our lives. You know, one person that we love can be one part of the country away, and another person can be, you know, the other side of the world. I mean, I have it at the moment. My daughter lives in Nottingham, my mother lives in Manchester, and I live in Birmingham, and I feel like, you know, the three of us will never get together. And it's those things in life, I think, that matter, really. It's about keeping families together and also being able to have, as a woman, and a woman certainly in your 40s and 50s, what you need too, really.
Yeah, and Australia's lovely, but it's so far away.
Absolutely, the other side of the world, you know, and a different culture to a degree, you know, in certain ways, this sort of lovely sunshine, beachy culture that we in the Midlands don't really have, you know, we don't have that. We're pretty landlocked. So, say my heroine is from the Midlands, and it's about her adjusting too, if she decides to do this. It's about her adjusting to a completely different way of life. And that's, again, difficult, you know, in your 40s and 50s. Yes, we want new things, but how new do we want them? And can we face these challenges, you know? And when they come, are they scary? And if they are, perhaps we should take them because they're scary.
Yeah. Is there going to be more with Dan and Faye, do you think, after this book?
Well, who knows? Who knows? I'm writing something quite different at the moment, but, you know, if readers have... I mean, I wrote Love, Lies and Lemon Cake in 2014, and Faye had a living list, and as I say, a woman in her 40s, she had this living list, not a bucket list, a living list, because, you know, she doesn't want to... There's no death involved, she just basically wants to live. And a lot of my readers have been in touch to say, how did she get on and what's happened? And I've had so many emails and messages on Facebook to say, you know, what happened next? But I thought, yeah, what happened next? And so that was 4 years ago I wrote the first one. And so this is what happened next.
Great stuff. Really. People want to find out what happened next, Love, Lies and Wedding Cake, the book is called, and it's by Sue Watson, who we've been chatting to. Sue, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
TRE. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Mark Edwards. He writes psychological thrillers in which terrifying things happen to ordinary people. His first solo novel, The Magpies, reached the number one spot on the Amazon UK Kindle bestseller list, as did his third novel, Because She Loves Me. He's also co-written various crime novels with Louise Voss, like Killing Cupid and The Blissfully Dead. He's with us on the book show to talk about his latest novel. It's called The Retreat. Welcome to the book show, Mark.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Pleasure, thanks very much for joining us. And you've had quite a sort of interesting journey, if you like, to do with publishing and writing your books. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, I have. There's been lots of ups and downs. I mean, I spent years trying to make it as a writer, writing lots of unpublished novels, and then in 2011... Louise and I, my co-writer, decided to self-publish a couple of the books that we'd written, Killing Cupid and Catch Your Death, and they did really well, getting to number one and two on the Amazon charts. That then led to a deal with HarperCollins, and so we had four books come out with them, but unfortunately they didn't do as well as everybody hoped. So then I went back to self-publishing and self-published The Magpies, this is in 2013, and got to number one again, and that then led to a deal with Thomas & Mercer, which is part of Amazon Publishing, and everything's gone really well since then. I've actually had seven number one bestsellers on Amazon now.
Wow.
And I'm working full-time as a writer and supporting my family doing it. So yeah, I had a bit of a bumpy start, but it's all gone quite well the last few years.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And great to know how well self-publishing has worked for you, because I think it's easy for a lot of wannabe authors, if you like, to think that, you know, that's kind of, well, not as good as getting it done properly with a publisher. But I guess you disagree.
Well, it certainly worked to give me a start. I mean, I do like having a publisher. I like being part of a team and having a professional editor. When you're self-published, you can hire editors, but actually having an in-house editor and publicist, the marketer, and all of that publishers give you, for me, I prefer that. But self-publishing was a way to prove to people that I could find readers and get an audience, and that people liked my book. So it was a really great way to get in.
Yeah.
I think it's tougher these days than it was when I started, 7 years ago. It's much harder to be successful through self-publishing, I think, especially because... Well, the traditional publishers have finally worked out how to sell e-books, so it's not as easy to get up the charts.
Yeah. So, how do you publicise your books then? When you were self-publishing, as you say, you haven't got a team behind you. How were you getting them out there?
I did lots of blogging. I did some stuff on social media, and it was just. For the first few months, it was just a case of almost kind of hand-selling every copy. Like, every sale was an effort. And then when you start to get good reviews and get up the rankings and the Amazon algorithms start to kick in, then the sales started to pick up. And then when you're up kind of near the top of the charts, it's much easier. I mean, it was a lot of hard work to get up there, but then... It all kind of took off when the books got visibility and people could see them and they sounded intriguing and they had good reviews.
It's amazing what good reviews, what a difference they can make.
I know. Although actually, I don't think bad reviews are that harmful. I think I know from talking to people that if you're browsing Amazon and you see a book that's just all got 5-star reviews, people can be a bit suspicious of that, and they think that either the book that... the author's just kind of bribed all their friends to write reviews for them. They like to see a good mix. And actually, I think that books that divide opinion, I mean, if you look at huge books like The Da Vinci Code and The Girl on the Train and 50 Shades of Grey, things like that, they're all books that really divided opinion. People either really love or hate them.
That's true.
So,
they did very well.
Yeah, and I think that people like they like to be able to make their own minds up. So having lots of reviews and most of them being good is definitely advantageous. But I know a lot of authors and people get very upset when they get a bad review. And I mean, I've got thousands of reviews now. I used to read every single one of them in great detail, and I used to get upset if I got a bad one. But now it's just water off a duck's back.
Oh, good. And I bet you're happier now.
Yeah, I am. I am. I'm much less stressed out than I used to be.
Good. So tell us a little bit more about the retreat then. Where is it set?
It's set in North Wales. I live in Wolverhampton in the West Midlands, so it's not too far away from where I live. And it's about a horror writer who goes to stay at a writer's retreat in this remote part of North Wales. And when he gets there, he discovers that the woman who runs the retreat, her daughter went missing 2 years before in an accident when her husband actually drowned in the local river, the River Dee, and everybody assumes that the little girl drowned as well, but her body was never found, so her mother's convinced that she might still be alive and be out there somewhere.
Wow.
So my main character kind of abandons writing his book and sets out to find out what happened to this little girl. And he then discovers that there's a local legend, a kind of folklore or urban myth about a witch who lives in the woods who takes children. It's not a supernatural novel. It's not like early Stephen King, where there's actually kind of ghosts and demons and so on. There is a logical explanation for everything, but there's a very kind of horror-like, creepy atmosphere and lots of people going deep into the woods trying to find the secrets of what happened to Lily, this little girl.
And the whole urban legends thing, the reason why that came about, it was inspired by your daughter, wasn't it?
Yeah, I've got a 10-year-old daughter, and she came home from school talking about Bloody Mary, you know, that legend where if you say Bloody Mary, I think, 10 times in a mirror, then she'll appear.
Yeah, gosh, I've forgotten that.
Well, it reminded me that when I was younger, we used to talk about that, and it just made me think about the power of these stories and how long they can last. And then I watched a documentary called Beware the Slender Man, which is really interesting, but it's about a case in America where a pair of teenage girls tried to murder their best friend because they thought that Slender Man is a kind of very modern urban legend who was born on the internet. They thought that Slender Man wanted them to kill this other girl and that they would then be able to go and live with him in his house. And it's a really fascinating and strange case. But anyway, this kind of led to me thinking about the power of stories and what people believe in and the danger of believing in scary stories.
Mm.
I can't really say much more because it would be a massive spoiler about what's actually going on in the book. But
well, don't,
that was the inspiration.
Okay, fantastic. And did you have to do quite a lot of planning for this? Were you aware when you first started writing as to exactly where the story was going to go and end?
Well, I tend to make most of it up as I go along, although I did know what had happened to Lily from the start. But I knew, because there's all this creepy stuff going on in the house, in the retreat where they're staying, and I knew why that was happening. But when it comes to actually planning out chapter by chapter and scene by scene, I don't sit down and plan it all out before I start. I know what's going on in the background, but I then work out how I'm going to get there and reveal all of it as I write it. I find that my imagination doesn't really work properly if I just sit down and try and make notes and plan things out. I actually have to be there writing and be in the characters' heads and put them in situations to figure it all out.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, different things work for different people. There's no right or wrong way on how to do it.
I know. Well, I know a lot of people who will sit down and kind of plot out the whole book scene by scene before they even start writing. But I think if I did that, I wouldn't actually want to write the book. If I knew everything that was going to happen, I would just be bored and move on to the next one.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Retreat, it is out now, and it's by Mark Edwards, who we've been chatting to. People can get a copy from the TRE bookshop section on our website, tre.radio. Mark, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.